We wrapped up another month, Thursday, April 30th, right here on Connecticut Today. As far as our coronavirus coverage, we, of course, aired the governor's daily coronavirus update. Governor Lamont talking about gradually reopening the state if some trends continue. Also, earlier in the show, we stepped back from our coverage for just a minute to talk to a professor from the Midwest who attended college at Yale and has written a book about the area of the country she lives in, the heartland, misconceptions about that and what the people are really like and what are their roots. Our next guest is a professor of U.S. history at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. She's written numerous other books, re-release of a 2019 title here, now available in paperback, but I thought it was a good idea to chat about this because we are in an election year and everybody talks about the heartland. Professor Kristen Hoganson is with us. The book is called The Heartland and American History. Professor, how are you? Thanks for being with us. We appreciate it.
It's great to be here, Paul.
The book. Give me the genesis of the book. And we hear the term the heartland tossed around like, you know, like Skittles are or candy, especially in an election year. What gave you the impetus to do this?
Right. So I'm a sixth generation Midwesterner, but I grew up on the East Coast. And in fact, I went to college in Connecticut. And I bought into a lot of ideas about the heartland, the thought that it is more provincial, especially rural and small town places in the heartland, more provincial than global cities such as New York and L.A., less connected than edgier places such as coastal areas and border states. And then I moved to East Central Illinois, to downstate Illinois, in the middle of the Corn Belt. And I turned on the radio my first day, and out came the weather forecasts for China, Argentina, and Brazil. And I realized that, you know, no matter how much I had been reading on globalization in the preceding years, I had no idea where in the world I'd landed, and the book is a result.
And those forecasts, was that a result of what, the agriculture industry out there? Is that why they were given those forecasts?
Exactly. It has to do with the commodity market. So part of it is, you know, what the futures prices will be. But there are also farmers in the area who are investing in farmland in places like Brazil. And part of the point is that rural corn, soy, other agricultural producers have been connected to global markets from the start. They, you know, never intended to be self-sufficient, have always pursued export markets. And one of the things that was more surprising to me was their dependence on the means of production, that in the 19th century they imported their breeding animals and sent bioprospectors around the world to scour for new plant materials, leading, for example, to the introduction of soy by the first decade of the 20th century. And, you know, as if you've flown over this part of the country and look down on those checkered fields, you know that soy is, you know, fundamental agricultural product today.
So why then, Professor, when we talk about the heartland, especially in a political sense here, why is it always the, you know, the person raising the American flag in front of the house with the white picket fence and everyone going to the meeting house and everybody playing ball in a cornfield? Not that those things don't happen, but why is that image in the forefront of many minds?
Right. So that's the thing that I try to get at in the book, is that I start with these common perceptions, which are, many of them are along the lines of what you're talking about. And some of them, you know, kind of extend from there to the idea of the heartland as local and insulated and isolationist, is the ultimate kind of national safe space. And when I talk about the heartland, I'm disaggregating like the urban heartland, right? The industrial heartland, which has always been associated with American power, right? That's the place from which, you know, U.S. might kind of emanates from. But the heartland of myth kind of focuses on these picket fences on the small town and rural United States. And there's been a tendency to associate that with real America, right? There's the thought that somewhere in the middle of the country is the heart, and it's the quintessentially all-American place, which, of course, is bunk, that it's a nationalist myth that people in the United States have told about themselves since the early Cold War, when the term took off. And it was used initially in reference to the small town and rural Midwest in the context of profound insecurities, right? The possibility that nuclear weapons, that long-range bombers, that intercontinental missiles could obliterate the United States. And I think it was in that context there was a search for a place that might be protected and buffered and be the repository for the national heart, even in a time of insecurity.
Professor Kristen Hoganson is the guest. The book is called The Heartland and American History. Yet, Professor, that image has been used really well by politicians over the years. I'm old enough to remember, I hearken back to the Reagan campaign commercials of, you know, that Morning in America campaign, which is considered one of the two or three best spots ever done in politics. And it just oozes and reeks of middle America, the heartland.
Right. So I think there's a, you know, exactly what I'm talking about trying to get at a real America that is at the heart of the country. And one of the things that I do in the book is just show what a distortion that is, that it's a nationalist mythology, but it's also a white nationalist mythology that really distorts the inner, you know, essence of the country, and also suggests that there are insiders and outsiders, and that the insiders are these, you know, small town residents and farmers of Northern European descent who are supposed to typify all that is true and the best about the United States. And one of the things that this mythology does is it suggests that the interior of the country, the heart of the country, is walled off from the rest of the world. And what I find in my book, you know, the deeper I drilled into the past, is the more connections to the rest of the world I uncovered, and that this part of the country was global before it became local, before it became national, and that if you really want to understand what's at the heart of the country, then what you will find is long histories of global connection, human mobility, and interdependence.
You also talk about in the book many Native American tribes and other indigenous peoples, which is fascinating, that actually roam that area.
Right. So one of the groups that I take as a case study are the Kickapoo people, who at the time of Columbus were living mostly in the Windsor, Ontario, Detroit, Michigan area, who were forced by the violence of the fur trade that escalated upon, you know, European arrival, forced into places like central Illinois, and then in the 19th century forced out of Illinois by the pioneers coming in. Some of the Kickapoo were relocated to Kansas and Oklahoma. Some ended up in Texas and in northern Mexico, where there are Kickapoo people today who have ancestors from the heartland, right, whose presence in the heartland predates that of the, pioneers who later claimed it as their own. And part of the point of the book is not only to think about, you know, for people living in the area, the connections that kind of have spiraled out from the Midwest or the American heartland, but also to think about people who have ancestral and longstanding ties to the region, for whom the region is still spiritually and emotionally significant, but yet who are often regarded by Middle America as outsiders, right? Even though their claims to place predate those of current residents.
And we continue with Professor Kristen Hoganson from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Name of the book: The Heartland and American History. You know, Professor, in the first part of our chat, we talked a little about the perceptions of the heartland, the racial makeup. If you recall, Pete Buttigieg, when he was still active in the presidential campaign, a couple of times he was talking about heartland values and values of Middle America that he saw growing up, you know, in and around South Bend, Indiana. Yet he was pretty pilloried for that by, you know, a lot of activists in the Democratic Party, I think, playing in to some of the racial attitudes that you spoke about in the first half of our chat.
What my book does in that respect is it questions a lot of those assumptions that, if lumped together, we can regard as the heartland myth, right? The set of ideas about place that are not really about place in the same way that other regional designations might be, like being a Westerner or a Southerner, or, you know, somebody from the Northeast. But I think with the heartland, there is a greater sense of national belonging, of insiderdom and outsiderdom, of normativity attached to ideas about the heartland that explain why it was such a potent cocktail, I guess, for him to be drawing on in those statements. And I think with my book and connecting it to the 2020 election, and you should know the book it's not about the 2020 election insofar as that I did the research before this election cycle, but I think it really speaks to the 2020 election because we will see many more references, I think, to the heartland in the months to come. And I think it's important for people to disassociate that from the Midwest, right? The Midwest is, you know, a place with a number of swing states, and how those voters go may affect the outcome of the presidential election. But when people talk about the heartland, it's about more than the Midwest, right? It's about who we are as a people, what kind of a nation we are at heart. Are there insiders and outsiders in this nation? Are we going to be inward-looking or outward-looking? Are we always going to be regarding ourselves as victims of sinister foreign forces, or will we fess up to the role that we have played globally for, you know, the last couple hundred years? It's about what's the nature of American greatness. I think that's tied into ideas about the heartland. And it's about, would we do better to conceive of the world through misleading but comforting myths, or through more open-eyed, evidence-based analysis? I think all those issues are at stake in references to the heartland and make the book relevant to more than just, you know, the 2020 election cycle, but to kind of more profound conceptions of who we are as a people.
Do you think people who live in that area, some of the people you spoke about in the first half of our chat, do you think they make enough of an effort to research this, to look deeper into the past of who they are, where they came from, and what their reality is now in America?
Yeah, so my book, I think, has two different audiences in mind. One is the outsider audience, right? Like people in places like Connecticut who may have on occasion made references to flyover states, right? Who at times have looked down on the small town and rural Midwest and regarded them as less cosmopolitan and more local and provincial than the urban cosmopolitan flyers over. And I'm hoping to push back against the tendency to pathologize the center of the country. But I'm also writing for people in the region who I think have been cut off from their own past and have, you know, been kind of raised on histories of the region that are profoundly local, inward-looking histories that do very little to explain the much larger tapestry of connections that have produced this particular part of the world. And so my hope is that for those audiences, too, the book will really be revelatory and open eyes to ways in which history is, in fact, far more astonishing than myth.
She's a professor of history at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. The name of the book is The Heartland, An American History. Professor Kristen Hoganson, who tells me she went to school here in Connecticut. She went to Yale. And, Professor, you tell me you freely admit that you miss New Haven pizza. Is that what you're telling me?
I do, indeed. Just don't let anybody in my... the state of Illinois with its own Chicago pizza, find out.
And on that note, we thank you, Professor Kristen Hoganson. Good luck with the book. Take care of yourself. Be safe. And hopefully we can talk in the future. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Who are co-leading our Reopen Connecticut initiative. And as we said a while ago, every Thursday they'll give us a briefing on where we stand and their recommendations as we focus on May 20th. They just got off an exhaustive phone conference with the legislative leadership as well as we try and work our way through a reasonable schedule that keeps us safe and gets our economy going again. I'll give you a brief overview on what their recommendations have been, and they're certainly here to answer any questions you may have. Just very quickly on the daily summary, first of all, I think negative 41 hospitalizations. I think that's the eighth consecutive day of hospitalizations going down. As you remember, our first benchmark was 14 days of declining hospitalizations, 89 more fatalities, increasingly in the nursing homes, I might say. That's something we have to think about seriously. The 933 positive cases, I think you heard from Rudy and Jane yesterday what a positive case is and how scary it can be. With that, I just wanted to walk you through some of the priorities and reopening criteria that the Reopening Advisory Board has come up with. And first of all, the 14-day hospitalization, declining hospitalization, we're on that metric right now. Number two is increased testing. We've talked about that broadly, but I want you to know this is not something for me to take lightly. This is not something for the business community to take lightly. It is absolutely vital. As you look what's going on in Germany and other places with the slight resurgence, if we're not absolutely careful. And also, testing is important for the businesses as they reopen. And we're finding that down in Georgia. Testing gives the consumer confidence that we're doing everything we can to keep them safe, even at that, say, open-air restaurant. So testing is on track. We're expanding that, and that's a real priority for me and a real priority for our team. Sufficient contact tracing. I think you heard over the last few days how we're ramping that up, hundreds of people making those calls. Again, give the consumer confidence that if they go into that particular store, we've got everything in place to make sure they're safe and keep the pandemic spread. Protecting high-risk populations. Let me say that in a personal way. I mean, it's the right thing to do. We know that certain members of our community are hit especially hard by this pandemic in terms of infections, in terms of fatalities. We're going to focus on those communities, so the African-American community, the urban communities, those who live in denser populations. It's the right thing to do, and it's also the smart thing to do, because if you want to make sure that this pandemic stays under control, we want to do everything we can to make sure there are no flare-ups around the region and around the world. And that's why we look at each of these communities in the denser populations. We prioritize testing there, and we prioritize treatment to make sure there isn't a potential for a flare-up there, what that means for those families and what that means for the greater public health. We now have two mobile testing vans. One was in North Hartford. They're going to homeless shelters. They're going to federally qualified health centers, places where people can't get to a drive-through test. So we're taking those high-risk populations very seriously. Healthcare capacity, I think that's important for COVID as well as non-COVID-related treatments. And make sure we have the capacity, which we do right now, to expand coverage and make sure we have room in case there is a flare-up going forward. Adequate supply of protective gear. We got a big shipment coming in the next day. We're getting gowns now. We have a good supply of masks, maybe less than the N95, certainly on the surgical masks. We're making those available to small businesses via the CBIA website. And we're monitoring this carefully. It's not like we have an endless amount of inventory, but as the Reopen Connecticut Committee tells us, expansion of the ability to provide those masks to more and more stores, more and more employees, more and more factory is key to our opening strategy. And finally, the appropriate physical distancing and the such, those regulations, sort of store by store and industry by industry. Indra's group, working with David Lehman, are working with the industry groups. It's not state government sitting there saying, these are the protocols that we think are best for you. We've got the restaurant association, the retail association, the hospitality, all coming to us with really thoughtful ideas on how they can keep their employees safe as well as their customers safe. And there's nothing more important to a small business to make sure their customers feel and know that they're safe going into that particular facility. This next chart, I think, is interesting to me on a couple of different fronts. This shows you what percent of our economy is already open, and as a percent of GDP, and how it's reflected in unemployment. Let me give you some broad numbers. We have a GDP, the value of everything bought and sold in the state of Connecticut, is about $245 billion. And if you want to see how our economy is put together, you'll see that about $106 billion, as you can see on that chart, is reflected in things that have always been open. That's essential retail, construction, manufacturing. That is a big piece of our economy that never closed and stays open, and yet about 11% of our total unemployment is reflected in those particular businesses, and we watch that carefully. That could be the fact that in construction, new home constructions are not picking up, it's slowing down. That could be the fact that Pratt & Whitney, open, staying open, Stanley Black & Decker, open, staying open, but because of loss of demand, there are some layoffs there. But that's, let's say, 30% of our economy open. The next piece over there is open but closed due to a lack or fear of demand. That's 38 out of, 10% or something of our overall GDP there. And what does that mean? That means we never closed down childcare. Thankfully, we didn't. Because we needed those daycare facilities open for at least the first responders. But a lot of them did close down due to lack of demand. You know, landscaping, hardware, a lot of facilities that are open right now, and we want them to be open right now, but you'll see that a lot of them aren't open. That represents a smaller piece of our economy, about $37 billion. And more importantly, it's about 29% of our overall unemployment rate. So 40% of our overall unemployment so far, as you can see, is related to things that are open. These are things that I'd like to think we have a good chance to get back going sooner rather than later, in particular that group that's in landscaping, hardware, childcare, open, but due to lack of demand, not going as fast as they could. The third category you see there, which is about $77 billion out of $245 is open, but they're working remotely. This is technology, insurance, finance, professional services, those that are, you can continue to do through telecommuting. And maybe over time, we're giving people the green light to go back to office if you have to. And my advice is probably don't have your entire staff there on any given day. Maybe you divide it up half and half in case there was infection. And of that, professional services, media, finance, insurance, capital of America, that represents only about 12% of our overall unemployed. And those economies are going to continue to go. But you want to know where the other half of our unemployed come from? They come from a group that represents just 10% of our economy. That's the service economy. Those are restaurants, salons, bars, and the such. Those are very people-intensive. So while they're not a big piece of our overall economy, they're an enormous piece of our unemployment rate. And that's the group that we're going to talk about in particular today as we slowly phase them back into the workforce starting on May 20th. So very quickly here, the how and the what, which our committee came up with, how we will operate, what are our reopen levels. Again, how we operate, we got a lot of that best intelligence by working with the business community and by working with the labor community to make sure that everybody who goes back to work is safe. And business and labor are both represented on these committees. And then what will we open? What will we open? Phasing by type of business. And that's interesting in this sense. You know, some places are talking about let's open this region but not that region. Some places are saying people under the age of 30 go first, but not people over the age of 70. And, Indra can explain, we have some of those demographic and regional considerations, but primarily the recommendation, which I'm very sympathetic to, is open up by industry types that you can do safely. What do I mean by safely? This is how our committee ranks in terms of what we can do safely. One is what they call contact proximity. And that's, I think, a fancy way of saying how close you are next to each other in your particular place of employment and how much social distancing you're able to do. The next category is called contact length. In some places, you're maybe next to only one or two people, but you can be next to them for, 10 minutes. So there's a greater opportunity for that virus to spread. You can imagine the difference between, the factory floor and the nail salon as you think about this. Number of contacts is in that same category. How many different people are you seeing over the course of that period of time or over the course of that day? So that is one broad category as we think about what businesses we can open when. And I was talking to Albert and Indra a little bit ago. I would put under that or within that category indoor-outdoor, because indoor the germ is much more likely to infect than it is outdoor. The second health risk scoring that we've identified is one what they call disinfection. And that's how, by working with local businesses and labor, we can regulate the safety within a particular facility. You know, how often should you be disinfecting? What are the rules in terms of other protocols there? What are the social distancing rules? How safely can you do it if it's a small store versus a big salon? So that's the health risk story that our committee came up with, an amazing group of individuals from science as well as business. This next chart is just a little broader in terms of most restrictive to least restrictive as we open up starting on May 20th as we go through the summer. And I'll just tell you that broadly speaking, it's maybe there are different categories in there in terms of how big a group. We go with a 5 to 10 now. We can have bigger groups later. Maybe we say everybody over 60 should stay close to a home now. Maybe later on in the season it's over 70. What are those protocols in terms of social distancing? You'll see that ramps down as we reopen level one, and that gives you some broad sense of how we think about the reopening strategy over a period of time. And next up is probably the one most relevant. And this gives you our preliminary ideas based upon the facts of the ground, what we think we can do when. You know, right now, as we said before, well over 60% of our economy is already open, manufacturing, essential retail, real estate, utilities, construction, childcare, daycare, and hospitals, although some, as you heard, are not operating at full capacity right now, which is why it's so important that we give people the confidence that they can go back when it is safe for them to go back. And what we're thinking about right now in terms of opening dates is as follows. Restaurants are a big piece of that service economy. I know what that means in terms of employment. I know what that means in terms of bringing our cities back to life. And I also know what it means in terms of a virus spread. And there we're talking about allowing restaurants to open outdoor only starting May 20th. And, as Albert would tell you, that's conditioned upon making sure we have the testing, making sure we have the contact tracing. And I'll be particularly interested in looking at what's going on in Georgia and Oklahoma and some of those states that have sort of a four-week head start on us in terms of opening up a facility like that to make sure we don't see any surges or spikes in there. The remaining retail we're looking at, those are the smaller stores, right on Main Street, the toy store, the shoe store, boutique, jewelry. Find out what are the rules that we have there in terms of social distancing, mask going forward. Offices, we talked about that, where we still recommend anybody that can telecommute to do so. But if there's some need for some people to go back, this is a time that you can start putting your foot in the water there. Let me skip over personal services for a second. Museums and zoos, let's start on May 20th. Let's start with just outdoor only. I'm hearing from Mystic Seaport and others, this is how we want to open, and this is how we can do it carefully. And getting good intelligence from them gives us some confidence that we can slowly open the spigot and allow people to visit there. Additional outdoor recreation, camping, mountain biking, I was interested in reading the Hearst poll I saw in the newspaper the other day, and said the number one thing that people of Connecticut want to have reopened again are parks and hiking trails. Well, we never closed our state parks and hiking trails, but this is just broadens that in terms of camping and other recreation, university research programs. Personal services. I say that with a little note of caution on a personal basis, but I'm going to follow the lead of people who know better. I know how important hair, barbers, salons, nails are. I know it's been a long time. I know it's getting a little awkward. I also know that it's tougher to enforce social distancing in an environment like that. But based upon what we see in Georgia and other places, people aren't flooding in. People are doing it by appointment. So Indra and Albert and their team are going to come up with some protocols that maybe give us the opportunity to get that started up on a limited basis starting on May 20th. So May 20th is an important startup date for us. I know you're wondering about some other activities, and we're going to report early next week on schools and other social gatherings. So if you would, give us a little more time as we try and test that out and get a little more information than we have right now. And, you know, with that, I guess maybe we should just open it up to questions, unless Albert Indra, is something you'd like to add beforehand. How about some questions?
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Yes, Governor. I mean, I think this is the information that we've been looking for ever since the state went into self-quarantine. Are there going to be any age restrictions on who's going to be able to go back? And if someone of any age is a little hesitant to go back to work, is there any protection for them?
I'll start, and then let me ask Indra Albert. I think you're going to find a lot of self-policing. People over the age of 70, I will argue, it's still unsafe for them to go out, even on May 20th, to some place where there's a group. Right now, the folks who are older are self-policing, and I think that's really important. Whether we have to set regulations around that, let me ask the experts.
Yeah, so thank you for that question. Now, even as we go to reopening in very baby steps or small steps, the economy, we're going to be worried about the people most vulnerable for the, from the COVID virus. And those are going to be, of course, the elderly. So certainly the recommendations are going to be continue shelter in place for the elderly. These are going to be certainly the people who have the highest risk, which are over 70 years of age. And then we're going to be going by industry to industry to develop, methods of protection. Of course, there are people who are working over 60 years of age. That's the work we're doing right now to exactly understand what the risk is and how that could be potentially mitigated in different environments, and whether sheltering in place for that age group is going to need to continue.
And then will there be any protections for someone who, doesn't fall into an older age range category, who just isn't comfortable?
So as the governor said, these are opt-in, requirements to going back to work or actually going to going out in public. And I think the bottom line is that we want to protect the elderly, given their risk. That is going to be, an important way that we're going to mitigate or reduce the overall harm in the population. In terms of, just to reinforce from the public health side, the other groups that are at risk, these are the people who have comorbidities or have underlying medical conditions. They are also an important group that we're going to want to shelter in place and come up with specific recommendations to protect this group.